I want to take up in volume 4 and begin with June the 13th, 1901. If you want to put a heading on this, it's No Cross, No Crown. After a long silence on the part of my adorable Jesus, at the most, a few things about the scourges he wants to pour. This morning, as I was oppressed and tired because of my hard position, especially because of the continuous privations to which I am often subjected, I saw Jesus for short instances, and he told me, "My daughter, crosses and tribulations are the bread of eternal beatitude." In other words, you can decide yourself what height you want in heaven by the crosses and tribulations that you accept from the Lord. I understood, Louisa said, that as we suffer more, more abundant and more enjoyable will be the bread that will nourish us in the celestial dwelling. So, no cross, no crown. It's that actually that simple. And the bigger the cross, the bigger the crown. If you're size 10 on earth, you get a size 10 cross and you get a size 10 crown. If you are size 20 on earth, you get a size 20 crown. Now, a size 20 crown doesn't fit a size 10 head. So you get the crown that actually suits you, that you've actually worked towards. So the greater the deposit we receive in the future glory. So in Romans 8, Paul tells us that what God gives us in eternal glory is out of all proportion to anything that we can suffer in this life. Also in 2 Corinthians 5, I think it is, St. Paul says that we actually work on earth to make our own dwelling in heaven. And you can make it with wood or straw, or you can make it with silver and gold. You can make a hut or you can make a palace, depending on your own decision. So June the 18th, 1901, I have a VIP on this one. And this is that we are obliged to give glory to God in everything we are. As I was in my usual state, I saw my sweet Jesus for a little, and I began my laments about my poor state of his privations, and about a sort of tiredness, both physical and moral, as if I felt my poor nature crushed. Now, if the Lord doesn't actually sustain her, she cannot stay alive because her life is absolutely abnormal. So, as if I felt my poor nature being crushed and failing me in all its parts. And then after I said all of this to Jesus, he told me, "My daughter, don't be concerned about your feeling you're falling apart." I mean, it's incredible. "Don't you know that everything must be sacrificed for me, not only in the soul, but also in the body?" So now we have a new picture for Louisa. She is a living sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving to God, a daily sacrifice of praise. And Jesus continued, "And that from the tiniest little particles of your being, I demand my glory." And then, "Don't you know that from the state of union, one passes on to another state, that of consummation?" 2 Thessalonians 1:12. So the state of union is like we get married, and the state of consummation is that the marriage is consummated in this oneness of the two. So the state of consummation is a higher state than just the state of union. "It's true that I'm not coming as usual so as to chastise the people. But I use this also for your own profit, which is not only that of keeping you united to me, but of consuming you for love of me." Now, it's only volume 4, and Louisa still doesn't understand that the privation of Jesus is a very big part of her sacrifice. She doesn't accept it all that well, and every now and then she's able to offer it out of love for him. But most of the time, she just suffers it. After all, Jesus said, do you not have great reason? You do not have great reason to afflict yourself. First, because when you see me, it's always from your interior that you see me, and this is the sure sign that I am with you. And also because not one day has yet come in which you can say that you have not seen me perfectly. Now, that is an absolutely extraordinary statement of Jesus. No other saint, apart from our Blessed Mother, could say that. After this, Jesus' voice assumed a sweeter and more benign tone, and he added, my daughter, I recommend to you very, very much that you let not even the slightest act, which is not patience, resignation, sweetness, sameness, that's the firmness, the immutability he's talking about, tranquility in everything come out of yourself. Now, this applies most particularly to the time of the privations when she goes into a complete crisis. Otherwise, he said, you would dishonour me. So he's demanding complete heroism from her. In these early volumes, it looks as if that heroism is almost impossible. But when you get up beyond volume 20, it's perfectly normal for her. So he is working on her bit by bit. That is Philippians 1:6. Work I have begun in you, I will complete. And he does complete this work in her in a very wonderful way. So he said, don't let anything that's not patience or resignation or sweetness and so on come out of you. Otherwise, you would dishonour me. And it would be the same as it would happen to a king who lived in a palace, which was well adorned inside. But on the outside, it could be seen full of cracks, stained and about to collapse. Would people not say, what? A king lives in this place? And yet such an ugly configuration can be seen on the outside as to make one fear even to draw near it. Now, what Jesus is saying is our faults, which are obvious to other people, are real blocks to them accepting the fact that God is working in us. Even Mahatma Gandhi is famous for having said that he loved Christ, but he couldn't bear Christians. He said not one of them is like him. And so we can really put people off. So Jesus continues, who knows what a king, oh yeah, who knows what a king he must be like? Would this not be a dishonor to the king? Now think that if anything which is not virtue comes out of you, they, that is everybody else, would say the same about me. And they would also dishonour the Lord, because if the Lord puts up with anything, then the moral standards go down, as we see in the church today, because the priests are not holding up a high moral standard. And I who live inside of you would remain dishonoured, Jesus said. So June the 30th, 1901. These are signs by which you will know that you have grace. Therefore, put a VIP on this one as well. Louisa said, as I was in my usual state, my most sweet Jesus made himself seen for a short time, all transfused in me. Now, my book has a capital M there, and it should be a small M because he's talking about Louisa. And he told me, my daughter, do you want to know what the signs are to know whether a soul possesses my grace? Now, Jesus said in volume 2, I am grace. Okay. So whether we possess the presence of God or not. And Louisa said, Lord, as your most holy goodness pleases. And he replied, well, the first sign, so put a number one here, is to see whether the soul possesses my grace, is that in anything that belongs to God, which she may hear or see externally, she feels a sweetness, a gentleness fully divine in her interior, which is not comparable to anything human or terrestrial. It's the same as to a mother who recognises the fruit of her womb in the person of her son, even from his breath, his voice, and she delights with joy. Or as two intimate female friends who, in conversing together, manifest the same sentiments, inclinations, joys, afflictions to each other. And since each one finds her own things engraved in the other, they feel such pleasure in them, such joy, and take them to heart so much that they cannot detach themselves. In the same way, the interior grace which resides in the soul, on seeing externally the fruit of her womb, that is, on recognizing herself in those things which form her very existence, corresponds with them and makes the soul experience such joy and sweetness that one is unable to express it. Now, the examples that Jesus gives here are very interesting. First of all, to recognize that you're in the state of grace, many people are not sufficiently recollected or attentive to really know how they're feeling as to whether it would be grace or not. That would take a great deal of recollection. But it would be normal for someone like Louisa, who's sitting there in the bed giving all her attention to the Lord. And then the first example he gives is of a mother recognizing even the breath or smell or anything of her child. And then he gives an example that you're not expecting, and that is two intimate female friends. Now, one of the things that you find when you look at the history of the church is that saints don't come by themselves. Saints usually come in clusters. And we have some amazing, let me call them couples, but I don't mean that sexually. I mean that the friendship is between a man and a woman, and they spur one another on to sanctity. If you take Francis and Claire in the 11th century, if you take Francis de Sales and Jane de Chantal, just to give you two examples out of many, it's usually that. But Jesus here is giving friendship between two women. Friendship between two women can actually be very deep, and they can be very, very close spiritually. And if you find such a friend, it is an amazing grace, and you should really appreciate it, because both of them spur each other on to sanctity. So the second sign that Jesus speaks about is that the words of the soul who possess grace are peaceful, and they have the effect of casting peace into others. Now, you see, the God of peace is the God of grace, same person. So Jesus gives the sign of peace so very often as the sign of his presence. He is the Prince of Peace. He brings peace. He only operates within us in peace. And when the grace is deep within us, put Philippians 4:7, that we have the peace that passes all understanding and guards our hearts and our minds in Christ Jesus. So, if the person claiming to be living in grace doesn't show that there is peace inside of them and manifest peace to others, then you know that their claim isn't true. And Jesus said so much so that the same things said by one who does not possess grace make no impression and they bring no peace. While if they're said by the other one who possesses grace, they operate in a marvellous way and bring peace back to others. I remember hearing a priest speak about a retreat, a priest's retreat in Rome some years ago. And Mother Teresa of Calcutta was invited to speak to them. And she came out on the stage and she spoke for approximately 5, maybe 7 or 8 minutes. And he said she didn't say anything that any of the rest of us couldn't say. But he said the only person in the entire retreat that left a lasting impression was herself. And here you have the effect of somebody speaking from a very deep personal relationship with God and communicating that grace and peace to others. So what she was communicating wasn't just her words. She was communicating the presence and glory and peace of God to them. And I remember this priest was telling me this about 6 months later. And he said the impression she made on them was very profound. So we come to the next paragraph. Moreover, Jesus said, grace strips the soul of everything and makes of her humanity a veil in which to remain covered. So that means that grace means that God is hidden in us, in our humanity. And it's a bit like the bread that is the external part of the consecrated host, and it's hiding the presence of Jesus in the Eucharist. So a person in grace becomes a living host. Okay. So let me read it again. Grace strips the soul of everything, that is, everything that is not of God, and makes of her humanity a veil with which to remain covered in such a way that as the veil is torn, one finds paradise in the soul who possesses her. So it's no wonder that true humility, obedience and the like are found in that soul, because there's nothing left of her. That means the earthy, muddy stuff. There's nothing left of her but a simple veil. And one can see with clarity how it is all grace that acts within her and keeps all the virtues in order for her and make her remain in continuous attitude towards God. So Jesus is describing a soul that's completely open to God all the time and open to the inpourings of God's presence and God's grace. It's a very good description of Louisa herself. So July the 5th, 1901. Jesus is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. As I was concerned about the state of my soul, all of a sudden my adorable Jesus came and said to me, "My daughter, do not be concerned, for I alone am the beginning, the means and the end of all your desires." With these words, I calmed myself in Jesus. May everything be for the glory of God. So I want to give you John 14, 6, Revelation 1, 8, and Revelation 21, 6. So we come to July the 16th, 1901. The beginning of evil in man is the distance between the love of Jesus and human love. After various days of privation, this morning Jesus deigned to come, transporting me outside of myself. Now, as I was present to him, I could see many people and the evil of the present generation. So that's Amos 3:7 and Isaiah 64:10. The Lord always tells his prophets first. So it's when Louisa goes into and out of the when Louisa goes into an out-of-the-body experience, there she sees clearly and she sees what God sees. And she comes back with this prophetic message because as Jeremiah, when he spoke to one of the false prophets, said, "Have you been in the counsel of God?" So these out-of-the-body experiences mean that Louisa is in the counsel of God. Okay. And that's a huge thing if you know your Old Testament. And in the counsel of God, God reveals what is happening on the earth to the person who is present to him. And as far as Jeremiah, the prophet, is concerned, that is the sign of authenticity of a prophet, that you've been in the presence of God. So Louisa said, when I was in the presence of Blessed Jesus, I could see many people and the evil of the present generation. So that's pre-World War One. And of course, that evil is the communism and Marxist atheism and materialism and rationalism and humanism and modernism and everything that was condemned by Pope Pius X. My adorable Jesus looked at them with compassion and turned to me and he said, "My daughter, do you want to know where the evil of man began? The beginning of it is as soon as he knows himself. That is, as soon as he begins to acquire reason. Man says to himself, 'I am something. I'm an important person. Now, this is very important and will explain to you why Jesus asks of us in the Divine Will Spirituality to accept our nothingness, which is way beyond humility, and to place our nothingness at his disposal, because it's only from that nothing that he can truly work. If you think of Blessed Mother's Magnificat in Luke chapter 1, she said that the Almighty had regard for his lowly maiden. Now, she was the most blessed of all creatures. And if anybody could be tempted to call herself somebody, it was her. But this reminds me of a story, not a story, of an incident that happened to me during my teaching years in Africa. I was doing a religion class, and for some reason we got around to asking the girls what would they like to become. And they said various things. And then one little girl at the back put her hand up and she said, "I want to become a very important somebody." And I said to her, "You know, you've spoken the truth. Everybody wants to become a very important somebody to somebody. And if the somebody you want to become important to is the Lord, then you will become great. But if you want to become an important somebody in your own right, you're going to give yourself terrible trouble on this earth." So this business, as soon as we acquire human reason, we say, "I am something," or "I am important." And this is the beginning of pride, which is independence of God. And of course, the world tells you to lean on yourself and sell yourself and all the rest of it. And believing themselves to be something, they move away from me, Jesus said. They don't trust me, who am the all, and they draw all their confidence and strength from themselves. So I want to give you Proverbs 3, verses 5 to 9, which tells you, "My son, lean not on your own understanding, lean upon the greatness of God and the wisdom of God." And this is the mistake that the world continuously makes. From this it happens that they even lose every good beginning. And by losing the good beginning, what will the end be? In other words, if they go wrong at a very early age, then their lives could go very seriously, criminally wrong. We know that if you plant a tree or a shrub and something goes wrong in the very early stages, you're not looking forward to a great shrub or a great tree. You're going to look forward to trouble. "Imagine yourself, my daughter," Jesus says. "Moreover, by moving away from me, who contains every good, what good can man hope for, since he is a sea of evil?" Now, this is the Lord speaking. This isn't me. And I'm reading this. He says that we are a sea of evil. "Without me," he said, "everything is corruption, misery, and without a shadow of true good. And this is the way the present society is," he says in 1901. It's 100% worse now. So I want to give you John 15, 5. "Without me, you can do nothing," Jesus says. Louisa responded, "On hearing this, I felt such affliction that I am unable to express it. But Jesus, wanting to cheer me, transported me somewhere else. And as I found myself alone with my beloved Jesus, I said to him, 'Tell me, do you love me?'" I think this is a scream. It's his duty to say to us, "Do you love me?" We cannot say it to him. I mean, have we forgotten Jeremiah 31:3? "I have loved you with an everlasting love, and I am constant in my affection for you." God's love never changes. You also have, I've forgotten the number of the psalm now. Oh yeah, Psalm 145, verse 17. "God only ever acts out of love, because God is love." And so his only motivation is love. Even when he sends us chastisements, the motivation is love. He wants to cure us. He wants to save us. He wants to bring us to heaven. So asking Jesus if he loves us, I think, is absolutely extraordinary. Jesus simply said, "Yes." And Louisa said, "But I'm not content with yes alone. but I would like it to be explained better how much you love me. He loves us infinitely. Why would she even ask? And he said, my love for you is so great that not only has it no beginning, it has no end. That's your Jeremiah 31:3. In these few words, you can understand how great, strong, constant is my love for you. I want to also give you John 15:9. As the Father has loved me, that is infinitely, absolutely, eternally, unconditionally, sacrificially, so I love you. So Louisa considered all this for a little while, and then she said she could see an abyss of distance between her own love and his. All confused, she said, Lord, what a difference between my love and yours, naturally, because his is infinite and it's eternal and ours is finite and we can't trust it. Not only does mine have a beginning, but as for the past, I see some voids in my soul of not having loved you. And Jesus, all compassion for me, said, my beloved, there cannot be conformity between the love of the Creator who is infinite and that of a creature who is finite. Put a VIP on this now. However, today, I want to tell you something which will be of great consolation for you and which you have never yet understood. Know that each soul, during the whole course of her life, is obliged to love me constantly with no interval. Our Penny Catechism told us that we were created to know him, to love him and to serve him throughout the whole of our lives and to be with him forever. So he said, and no intervals. And if the soul does not love me always, she leaves as many voids in her soul for as many days, hours or minutes in which she has neglected to love me. Now, unfortunately, these voids can be seen in heaven. Heaven can see that we're a bit like a colander. There's lots of holes in us. But no one will be able to enter heaven if he has not filled these voids. I want you to underline that in green, white and gold. We cannot enter heaven unless these voids are filled. So you can see why Jesus tells us in later volumes that 9 out of every 10 souls go to purgatory. And one will only be able to fill them by loving me twice as much for the rest of his life. And if he does not arrive at doing this, he will fill them by dint of fire in purgatory. Now, what you're seeing here is that heaven does not permit of any imperfections. Heaven does not accept a work that's not complete. Heaven does not accept a mission that has not been finished. And so when we get tired of religion and get switched off and don't want to do anything, we're simply building up a long purgatory for ourselves. Now, Jesus says to Louisa, when you are deprived of me, the privation of the beloved makes love double. And by this you come to fill the voids that were present in your soul. So Jesus tells her that the pain she experiences in the privations enable her to do the reparation that is actually required. Now, the problem is the rest of us don't have these experiences with the Lord. And so we have to do something to fill these voids ourselves. After this, Louisa said to him, my sweet good, let me come with you to heaven. And if you don't want it forever, at least for a little while. Now, she asks him to allow her to visit heaven. Please, I pray you, make me content. And he told me, don't you know that in order to enter that blessed dwelling, the soul must be completely transformed in me in such a way that she must appear as another Christ. Now, this whole section, you need to give it a heading, and it is Revelation about entering heaven. the conditions under which we can enter heaven. And we're not talking about sins and we're not talking about sinners. We're talking about so-called good people and people who think they're living a vibrant spiritual life. Jesus said we can't get into heaven unless we are like him. Only other Christs can go there. Otherwise, what impression would you make in the midst of the other blessed in heaven? I want to give you 1 John 3, verses 1 to 3. You yourself would be ashamed of being with them. And that's the very reason why souls go to purgatory. They realise I'm not ready to be here at all. Louisa said, it's true that I'm very dissimilar from you, but if you want to, you could make me similar. Louisa doesn't give up, as you know. Whenever she's in an argument with him, she just doesn't give up. And so to content me, he enclosed me completely within himself in such a way that I could no longer see myself but Jesus. Colossians 1:27. But in this way, we actually rose towards heaven. Everything is through him, with him and in him. We can do nothing by ourselves. John 15:5. So she could only rise to heaven through him, with him and in him. And as we reached a certain point, we found ourselves before an indescribable light. I want to give you 1 Timothy 6:14, where St. Paul says that the Lord lives in this indescribable light. This is something that none of us can comprehend. Okay. That light, of course, is God, 1 John 1:5. And the light is also the divine will, who is God. Before that light, one experienced new life, unusual joy never before felt. How happy I was. Even more, it seemed to me that I was in the fullness of all happiness because, as Jesus will reveal later on in these writings, the divine will is the source of all happiness. But as we advanced before the light, I suddenly felt much concern. I would have liked to praise him and to thank him, but not knowing what to say, I recited 3 glory bees and Jesus responded along. But as soon as I finished, like a flash, I found myself in a miserable prison of my body. Ah, Lord, she said, how come so little has my happiness lasted? Of course he couldn't take her any further because she wasn't dead. This was only a preview. It seems that the clay of this body of mine is too hard, as it takes so much to be shattered, and it prevents my soul from moving out of this miserable earth. Now, that's 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 to 10. But I hope that some vehement blow may cause it to be not only shattered, but pulverized. Then, since I would no longer have a home to be able to stay in, you would have compassion for me and would receive me forever into the celestial dwelling. So that's your Psalm 63. My heart and my soul and my entire being cry out for you. So July the 20th, 1901. The voice, how sweet the voice of the soul is for Jesus. Okay, so we're talking about the voice of the soul. As I was in my usual state, my adorable Jesus was not coming. Then after struggling and almost losing the hope of seeing him again, all of a sudden he came and he told me, my daughter, your voice is sweet to me, like the voice of the mother is sweet to a little bird. After she has left him to go in search of food with which to nourish him, as she comes back, what does the little bird do? On hearing her voice, he feels sweetness and makes feast. And after the mother has fed him, he huddles all up and hides under the maternal wing to warm himself and to be freed from the intemperances of the air. That's Luke 13:34, where Jesus says he hides us under his wings like a hen. Oh, how dear and pleasing it is for the little bird, this remaining under the maternal wing. So you are for me. Remember in volume 2, Jesus asked Louisa to be another mother for him on the earth. You are the wing that warms me and shelters me and defends me and allows me to take a safe rest. Now, what he means by warms, shelters, defends and allows him to take rest is that she makes reparation for others. She is prepared to suffer the crucifixion in order to pay some of the debt of the human race so that chastisements will be mitigated. And therefore the Lord can find rest in her, that she loves her neighbour as herself. Having said this, he disappeared, and I remained all confused and full of shame, knowing myself as so bad. But obedience wanted to increase my confusion, wanting me to write this. May the most holy will of God be always done. July the 23rd, 1901, Jesus speaks about his will and about love. Now, you hear me saying over and over again that the summary of the 36 volumes is divine will and love. As I was with many doubts about my state, on coming, my adorable Jesus told me, "Daughter, do not fear. What I recommend to you is that you remain always conformed to my will, because when the divine will is in the soul, neither the diabolical nor the human will have the strength to enter the soul to make fun of her." Now he's telling us, Jesus is telling us that the only way that we can be spiritually safe is in the divine will. Safe from ourselves and safe from the demons. After this, Louisa said, "I seemed to see him crucified. And since the Lord had shared with me not only his pains, but some sufferings of another person," he added, "this is true love, to destroy oneself in order to give life to others." Now, what he means by destroy oneself is to allow suffering to come to yourself in order to relieve others, either to heal them or to bring them to spiritual conversion or salvation if it's the moment of their death. So to destroy oneself in order to give life to others, to take upon oneself the evils of others and to give me one's own goods. So there's the pelican image. The pelican damages herself in order to get blood to feed her little ones. So July the 27th, 1901, we have doubts on the part of the confessor and Jesus answers them. Since the confessor had raised some doubts, when blessed Jesus came, I saw the confessor with him, and he was saying to him, "My working is always leaning on the truth." That is John 14:6. "I am the way, the truth and the life." And even though many times it appears obscure under enigmas, however, one cannot help saying that it is the truth. And even though the person does not understand my way of working with clarity, this doesn't destroy the truth. On the contrary, it makes one understand much better that it is a divine way of working, not a human way. So I want to give you Isaiah 55 verses 8 to 10. "My ways are not your ways. My thoughts are as different from your thoughts as the heavens are from the earth." In fact, since the soul is finite, she cannot embrace and understand the infinite. At the most, she can understand and embrace a few glimmers. As, for example, the many things said by me in Scripture and my way of working in the saints. Has this perhaps been understood by all with clarity? Oh, how many things are left obscured and in the midst of enigma. And yet, how many minds of the erudite and the learned have tired themselves in interpreting them? And what have they understood? One can say absolutely nothing compared to what is left to be known. You see, the learned and the erudite can only break into these mysteries insofar as they too are spiritual, and that they're allowing God to do this in their own lives. If they're not doing that, then they're merely dealing with intellectual thoughts and ideas, and therefore they are extremely limited in their ability to understand this. You'll find that in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. I can't remember the verses now, but St. Paul says that where are the philosophers now? Where are the wise men now that the foolishness of the cross has made them all look stupid? Okay. And so if they're only dealing with human philosophy and human thinking, there's no way they can deal with the supernatural. No way at all. But Jesus says, does this prejudice the truth? Not at all. On the contrary, it makes it shine even more. Therefore, your eye must be kept on whether there is true virtue and whether in everything it can be felt that truth is present. Now, notice true virtue and truth in terms of teaching. True and truth. Even though sometimes the truths are obscured, we know this ourselves in reading the volumes of Louisa. Some of the things in the higher volumes, you just don't get it the first, second or third time you read it. You have to move on spiritually and then you get it. As for the rest, one must remain tranquil and in holy peace. Having said this, he disappeared and Louisa said, I returned to myself. Here now, in July the 30th, 1901, we're talking about pride and humility, utterly essential things in the spiritual life. And the whole Bible speaks about pride and humility. So I'm not going to give you too many references because I'd have to give it them all. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, Blessed Jesus transported me outside of myself into the midst of people. Oh, what blindness. Oh, dear. I have to give you Isaiah 6:9, where when Isaiah saw the Lord in his glory in the temple, he suddenly realized that the people were so blind that, you know, they couldn't see. They're so deaf, they couldn't hear. They were so dumb, they couldn't speak because they had hardened their hearts and turned against the Lord, causing the blindness. You also have John chapter 9 and verses 40 and 41. Jesus had healed a man from being blind from birth. As far as we know, the man had no eye sockets. And Jesus actually created eyes for him. And at the end of the whole process, the Pharisees and the scribes who were the leaders said, we're not blind, surely. And Jesus said, if you were, I could heal you. But since you claim to see, I could do nothing. OK, so there are none so blind as those who refuse to see. And this is one of the problems that Jesus had all the time with the leaders of Israel. They absolutely refused to see. So Louisa says, what blindness. Now, when society deteriorates, you're dealing with spiritual blindness. And this is describing our society perfectly. Almost all were blind and a few had short sight. Only very few appeared like the sun and in the midst of the stars with extremely sharp sight. Now, they're usually the saints. All intent on the divine sun. And this sight was conceded to them because it was fixed in the light of the word humanate. My goodness, what a word. The word incarnate, we say. Okay. All compassion, Jesus told me, my daughter, how pride has ruined the world. It's the first and the greatest of the deadly sins because it blocks us off from God. It has reached the point of destroying that small light of reason which all carry with them from birth. You see, as society deteriorates and people go deeper and deeper into spiritual blindness, they become more and more irrational. Know, however, that the virtue which most exalts God is humility. Our Lady said that in her Magnificat in Luke chapter 1, verses 46 to 55. And the virtue which most exalts God, which most exalts the creature before God and men is humility. And again, you have the Magnificat that all generations will call me blessed. Having said this, he disappeared. So I want to give you Matthew 23, 12. In Matthew 23, Jesus gives his terrible indictment against the scribes and Pharisees. And it's because of their pride and their arrogance and their total spiritual blindness and hardness of heart. I want to give you 1 Peter 5, 6. And I want to give you James 4, 6. So Louisa said that Jesus came back later, all panting and afflicted, and said, "My daughter, three terrible chastisements are about to happen." And then he disappeared like a flash without giving me any time to tell him one word. Okay. So August the 3rd, 1901, I have a VIP on this. The soul who possesses grace has authority over hell, has authority over human beings, and has authority over God himself. So authority over hell is Luke 10, verses 18 to 20. And over God himself is Matthew 18, verses 19 to 20. This morning, my adorable Jesus was not coming. Then after much waiting, the Virgin Mother came, bringing him almost by force, but Jesus would escape. Then the Most Holy Virgin told me, "My daughter, do not become tired of asking for him. Rather be importunate, because this escaping of his is a sign that he wants to send some chastisement, and therefore he escapes the sight of his beloved ones." So here you have Blessed Mother explaining again to Louisa that Jesus' absence is to do with the fact that he is chastising. "You, however," Blessed Mother said, "do not stop, because the soul who possesses grace..." Now, this is the Blessed Mother speaking. And we should listen to mothers, you know. "You, however, do not stop, because the soul who possesses grace has authority over hell..." That means we can command the demons, "over human beings, and over God himself. In fact, since grace is part of God himself, as the soul possesses it, does she perhaps not have the power over that which she possesses?" That's incredible. Our Blessed Mother knew about that power because it was the power of the fullness of grace that she had that made her intercession for the incarnation actually happen. She actually brought it about. Power over God. Louisa continues, "Then after much resistance forced by the Queen Mother and importuned by me, Jesus came, but with an imposing, serious appearance, such that one wouldn't dare to speak." Now notice the authority he has, that if he has this kind of appearance, even Louisa, who loves him to distraction, has fear. "I did not know what to do to make him break that appearance so imposing. I thought I would come out speaking nonsense, saying to him, 'My sweet good, let us love each other. If we ourselves do not love each other, who else can love us? And if you are not content with my love, who will ever be able to content you?'" Okay, very wonderful thing to say there, because Louisa is aware of the very great height of her love. And so she says, "Look, if someone who loves you as much as I do can't get through, nobody will get through." She's very much aware of the fact that others love at a very lower level. And so she said, "Please give me a sure sign that you are content with my love. Otherwise, I will faint. I will die. But who can say all the nonsense I spoke? I believe it's better to move on. However, it seemed that with this, I was able to break that imposing air of his. And he told me, 'Only when your love will surpass the river of the iniquities of men, then will I be content with your love. So think of increasing your love, for I will be more content with you.'" This is totally amazing. He says that he'll only be content with her love if it surpasses all the sins of humanity. That's absolutely unbelievable. And so he said, think of increasing your love. How on earth could you increase your love? The only thing you can do is enter into the divine will, and you take Jesus' own divine love, and with his own divine love, love him with that. That's the only way you can do it. There is no other. So I want to give you August the 5th, 1901. Mortification is the sight of the soul. So volumes 1 to 4 are the foundation volumes of this whole spirituality. And the Lord doesn't want us to forget that mortification and self-denial are part of the whole scene. As I was in my usual state, my blessed Jesus was delaying in coming. I felt I was dying for the pain of his privation when all of a sudden he came and he told me, "My daughter, just as the eyes are the sight of the body, so mortification is the sight of the soul. Therefore, mortification can be called eyes of the soul." We need to remember that, don't we? August the 6th, 1901, the love of the blessed is a property of God, which the love of the pilgrim souls is like a property which he's in the act of acquiring. Now, here again, we're speaking about love, and Jesus is going to say that the love of the blessed is already acquired property for him, but he's looking for more territory by going around us looking for love from us. This morning after I received communion, my adorable Jesus made himself seen all in suffering and offended such as to arouse compassion. I clasped him all to myself and I said to him, "My sweet good, how lovable and desirable you are. How can people not love you? Even worse, they offend you. By loving you, one finds everything. And loving you contains all goods, while not loving you means that all good escapes. And yet, who loves you?" "Please," she said, "my dearest treasure, put aside the offences of humans and let us pour ourselves out in loving each other for a little." And then Jesus called the whole celestial court to be spectator of our love, and he said, "The love of the whole of heaven would not render me satisfied and content if yours were not there united with it." In other words, now I know Louisa is a very special case and everything, but Jesus is saying that your love and mine is so important to him that he thinks heaven isn't complete without it. Isn't that absolutely astonishing? That's like saying you have one of these masterful paintings done by a great artist, and there are all kinds of colours in it. Each one of those little strokes is absolutely essential for making the marvel of the entire picture. And so each one of us will be a little stroke of love with different colours as well in heaven. And each one is very important. So he said, "The love of the whole of heaven would not render me satisfied and content if yours were not there united with it. More so, since that love, that's the love in heaven, is my own property, which no one can take away from me, while the love of the pilgrim souls is like property that I'm in the act of acquiring. And since my grace is part of me, and my being is most active, as it enters into hearts, the pilgrim souls make traffic of love." Now, that traffic of love is this divine commerce, which is illustrated in Genesis 28 with Jacob's ladder. And Jesus said that he was the fulfillment of that in John 1:51. Okay, this commerce of love, that we love him and he loves us. So his love for us is the source of all life, all grace, all beauty, everything. And our love for him is a response. Just like you give life to a child and you feed the child and clothe the child and love the child and medicate the child and house the child and do absolutely everything and everything. And the child returns the love. The love is the completion of the circle. So as my grace enters into hearts, the hearts of the pilgrim souls, It can make the traffic of love, and this traffic expands the properties of my love. Now, the properties of my love means expands the kingdom of God. And I feel such taste and pleasure that if it were missing, I would remain embittered. Instead of the word taste, we would say satisfaction. So write the word satisfaction there. I feel such satisfaction and pleasure that if it was missing, I would remain embittered. That's why without your love, the love of all heaven would not render me fully content. And you should know how to traffic well in my love. That's very important. As a victim soul, she should learn how to use the love of Jesus well. Now, we need to learn to traffic in God's love as well. And by that, I mean that we enter into him. We fuse ourselves completely with him. We take his divine love. Once we have fused ourselves, we make it our own. And we bathe all the souls in purgatory with his love so that they are released. We bathe all the dying souls with his love so that they will surrender to him. And we bathe all souls past, present and future with his love so that they will come to know and love him. And we need to make the intention to do that permanently at every moment of every day, of every week, of every year. You should know how to traffic well in my love, for by loving me in everything, you will render me happy and content. Louisa says, who can say how amazed I was on hearing this and how many things I understood about this love? But my tongue is stammering and I'll have to leave it there. She just is not able to actually say the words. So I want to give you August the 21st, 1901. And I have a VIP on this one as well. As I was in my usual state, I found myself outside of myself. And after going round and round in search of Jesus, I found the Queen Mother instead. And oppressed and tired as I was, I said to her, my most sweet mother, I lost the way to find Jesus. I don't know where else to go or what to do in order to find him again. And while saying this, I was crying, and she said to me, my daughter, follow me, and you will find the way and Jesus. Now, there's a very, very important piece of teaching from Blessed Mother. She knows the way to find Jesus, and she is our mother, and she is our guide as well. And she's the one who brings everybody to Jesus. Even more, Blessed Mother said, I want to teach you the secret of how you can always be with Jesus and live always content and happy, even on this earth. What you need to do is fix in your interior that there is only Jesus and yourself in the world and nobody else. And that he alone you must please, satisfy and love, and from him alone that you must expect to be loved in return and contented and everything. In other words, that you turn completely into a he and I world. And therefore we knock out all the extraneous stuff that's driving everybody crazy today. And you knock out all of those terrible films that people are watching and commentaries and everything else on the internet and the television that's distracting people completely. And it's not leaving them enough inner space or inner peace to be able to have this wonderful relationship with Jesus. Blessed Mother said, if you are in this way with Jesus, you will no longer be affected, whether you are surrounded by scorn or praise, by relatives or strangers, by friends or enemies. Jesus alone will be your all and all. He will be all your contentment, and Jesus alone will be enough for you in the place of everyone. My daughter, until everything that exists down here, that is on earth, disappears completely in the soul, one cannot find true and perpetual contentment. Now, what she's saying here is that until we reach complete detachment from the world, we cannot find God completely. We've a lot of work to do, haven't we? Now, while she was saying this, Jesus came into our midst as though from within a flash. That's the way he appeared after the resurrection as well. I took him and brought him with me, and I found myself inside of myself. Now, I'm going to leave it there for this time.